Were there particular professors who meant a lot to you?
Yeah, one who just recently has retired, Delos D. Hughes, who at the time that I showed up on campus was the chairman of the politics department, and his nickname around campus was Easy D. Hughes. Everyone knew him as Easy D because it was very easy to get a D in his class. A little harder to get a C. And fairly difficult to get a B and virtually impossible to get an A. A fantastic, fantastic teacher. He was my advisor, so I knew him first as an advisor, and I just liked him. Kind of a shorter man with gray hair and a beard who was just warm and would look at you and ask you a question and smile and make you feel like he really was happy to be spending time with you, even if he was on his way someplace, on his way to class. Or he just always made time for you, or would make time for you if he truly was busy. And I that made a real impression upon me, and you know, I ended up being a student of his, and I did not get a D in his class. I think I got a B, but he was difficult, but I'm convinced to this day that, although I don't believe in reincarnation, if I did, I would think that he is the reincarnation of Socrates. I mean, if ever there was a man who has mastered the Socratic method, it's Professor Hughes. He was just wonderful. He taught really the gut course in the politics department. Politics 265, Political Theory, Plato through Burke. And the reading was very dense and very conceptual. We're talking, it was political philosophy, and he just was fantastic. The way he would ask a question of you that was already at least two leaps beyond simply, well, what does Plato have to say about this? Well, what is Rousseau's position on this? You know, he would assume that you already knew that. He was already two exits down the freeway from you on that. He wanted to already put you to the test. I was a politics major here. I had started out pre-med, and after a year in the science department, I didn't think that's what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And my father was an attorney, and still is, and I'd always been interested in politics, and so it was, I sort of changed gears and became a politics major. And another influential faculty member was also in the politics department, Ken Ruscio, who's now the associate dean of the Commerce School. And at the time that I was here, he was the dean, associate dean of students, I think, for freshman and residence life. But his specialty was in public policy, and he taught some courses. And I got to know him not only through being his student, but also I was a dorm counselor my junior and senior years. And he, as the dean of freshman and residence life, was the supervisor, really the boss of all the dorm counselors. And so I got to know him fairly well through that too. And I'm trying to think of some other men. Jim Warren in the English department, who I think, I don't know how many, but quite a number of girls on campus had crushes on him at the time that I was here, and probably still do. But my senior year, the beginning of my senior year, I had looked back on what my academic experience had been. And after I'd taken the core requirement classes, I really concentrated largely on either politics or economics or business administration, the C school courses, because I thought, you know, if I decide not to go to law school, which wasn't a sure thing then, but, you know, a politics degree is kind of soft. I need to firm it up. I need to have some accounting, maybe some business administration. I need some to firm it up a little bit. Well, at the beginning of my senior year, I had this epiphany. I thought, my goodness, I'm at a liberal arts school, and, you know, I need to take advantage of it while I can get it. So I spent my senior year, I think, taking a Renaissance approach to my academic diet. And so I took an introductory literature course from Jim Warren, which was American literature, I think Whitman through Faulkner. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I loved the readings. I loved the work that I did in the course. And I did very well in the course. And I believe at one time or another, I liked Professor Warren just because of the way he dealt with the students and the mastery that he had, and the love that he had for the language. And I just seemed to hit it off with him. And at one point, he and I were talking, or maybe he put a comment on some paper that he was handing back about, too bad you weren't an English major, you know. I was thinking the same thing myself. Clark Mollenhof, professor, legendary journalist and professor of journalism. During my senior year, my Renaissance year, I thought, again, what am I going to be sorry that I didn't do at Washington and Lee when I graduate? So I thought, Clark Mollenhof, who is just a giant, I need to know this man. I need to take a course from him. And so I walked into his office one day, and I introduced myself, and I said, I'm not a journalism major. I'm a politics major. And I wanted to try and take what was essentially a capstone course for the journalism department, which really amounted to meeting in his office at a table about this size. He had his desk sitting down at one end of it, and then a table just like this emanating out from it. And the students, he limited it to 5 or 6 students. And we would sit around, and most of it consisted of him telling war stories from his days as a reporter in the White House press corps. And then the other, when we weren't doing that, he was assigning us to cover, to try and, I don't know, to, most of it was monitoring the federal government. What's the government up to? So we would order inspector general reports and comb through them and keep abreast of current events affecting particular departments. In any event, at the beginning of the semester, I walked in and I said, I really would like to take a course from you, and this will be my last opportunity. And he was just this big hulk of a man who, by that time, had lost an eye to cancer and recently had, I believe, had his salivary glands removed due to cancer. But he was this big hulk of a man, tough as nails, and just said, well, if you want to be here, you're the kind of person I want to have in this class. So where's the drop-ad slip? Let me sign it. So he let me in, and it was a wonderful experience. How much do I really remember about what I learned in that? Probably very little, but just the impression that this man made on me, it truly is inspirational. I'm sorry I never took a class from Sidney Cowling. I've had a chance to get to know him through his daughter, who was working here the year I worked in the admissions office, who was married to a guy named Tim McMahon, who used to work in the admissions office and who was a dorm counselor when I was a freshman. And through one means or another, I've gotten to know him on some level, but I feel remiss that I didn't take him for a course. I think that was a mistake. I wish I could take a course from him. Maybe he's got some free time sometime and I could take a correspondence course with him.
Well, I never miss a talk when he's giving a talk. He's a joy.
Absolutely.
Well, since you were a politics major, I presume you got involved in my convention.
I did.
Tell me about that.
Well,
who was your keynote that year?
I believe the keynote, that would have been 1988.
Uh-huh.
And so the keynote...
That wasn't Cuomo. He'd been before that, wasn't he?
He was, I think Cuomo was...
84, I think.
Maybe it was Cuomo.
Was it Cuomo?
Perhaps it was.
Didn't make much of an impression on you.
Well, most people will tell you that my convention is a lot of it is kind of blurry for those who have been through it as a student.
Tell me what you mean.
Well, there's a lot of partying that goes along with it. And as still a sophomore, I was still cutting my teeth, I think, in the party scene. The Sigma Aqua was never accused of being teetotalers, never accused of being sissies when it came to running with the big dogs late at night. By the same token, we were all law-abiding and pretty mild-mannered within those confines. I'm trying to think. What am I thinking? Bill Clinton.
Was he? Of course he was. Oh, my God. How can I guess? Oh, Lord, of course.
Yeah. Bill Clinton.
So you were at Zalman when he played?
I was not. I wish I could say that I was.
I wish you could say that you were, too.
You're trying to find someone to...
Well, Dallas was there.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, there's no shortage of rumors that seem to follow the president around now, and apparently also then, about goings-on. But my convention, at that time, what I did was limited mainly to helping build the West Virginia float, and then riding on the float with Miss West Virginia. We built a still and put it on the float. And there's actually a picture of me in the yearbook from that year wearing overalls and carrying a jug.
Your moment of glory.
My moment of true glory. I had arrived. But it was a neat experience. Even if it was all kind of stiff, to see how the convention process worked, the nominating process, and it was neat having someone like Bill Clinton here. I believe this is horrible. Was it Tip O'Neill that spoke also?
He's been here sometime fairly recently.
I'm pretty sure that Tip O'Neill was here along with him. And it's just a very festive time in the life of the university.
Did you get involved in doing research?
I did. I mean, but it was fairly limited. I mean, I solicited donations from alums back in West Virginia to help us build a float.
So do you feel like you learned anything about politics doing that, or did you learn about the tradition at Washington?
Well, I think a lot of that is politics. mean, you know, about government, maybe not, but about politics, yeah, I mean, you know, probably in the strict sense, whatever I learned about the political process in the strict sense was pretty marginal. And honestly, I think if really pressed, I think most people involved with it would tell you the same, except perhaps the people who are involved on the steering committee, who are, you know, really at the top echelon of the organization. I think for the rank and file, and I think this is probably pretty realistic. I mean, the rank and file are just kind of there for the festivities. And I know watching the two conventions recently, the national conventions, I think it's probably the same with them. I mean, that they're there for the fanfare, mm-hmm. and a lot of it's a production. And you know, I think our mock convention is pretty realistic in that respect. And I think the people who are, you know, behind the scenes and really organizing it, orchestrating it, they are the ones that really have the, who are digging in gold in terms of learning a lot about the way the thing works.
One of the things, I went to the convention this year and went to every minute of it. I loved it.
Yeah, I came back for it.
Were you here?
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was so exciting. I thought it was great. And one, well, then you were there, so you know what I'm talking about. One of the things that I found so intriguing was, I don't know, it was probably on the first night or the second day, that it became very apparent how overjoyed Washington Lee students were that they didn't have to pretend to be something they weren't. They kept saying they were so excited because this was a Republican convention.
Yeah.
In 1988, there was a lot of play acting going on, I presume.
You're exactly right. I got the, you know, there were very mixed emotions about the exercises in 1988. And I imagine mixed emotions in 1992. I was just getting ready to come back to campus from Washington. At that point, I spent a year working in Washington. So the political science, the politics degree did actually come into play at some point. But, yeah, I got that feeling too. And people, you know, it's no secret that, you know, such a high percentage of the student body here are politically conservative and call themselves Republican. So I felt a real release this time that I hadn't seen in years past. A lot of, you know, in the past when people would announce, you know, so the great state of South Dakota proudly cast its however many votes, you know, for, you know, Bill Clinton, the next president of the United States, you know, a lot of that was being said tongue-in-cheek, and now I think this past spring a lot of it was coming from the heart, or at least from the gut. so it was a, you know, WNL is never short on parties, whatever, whether it's fancy dress or mock convention, or we're good at doing that. We're really good at doing
Any
that.
Any particularly memorable fancy dresses for you?
I like, there was one, I think it was my first year here, maybe it was the second year, the Dark Continent. And the, of course, the motif was Africa, and remember they had an elephant, a baby elephant, out in front of Doremus Gym as you walked in, and I believe some other small animals. And you, I think the decorations that year were, I remember, as being fantastic. There's so many fresh green leaves, jungle-like leaves, that were really covered up everything. You couldn't tell that you were in an athletic facility. You know, as fancy dresses have come and gone, and I've been more in since 1986 than I haven't been at. You know, you get some where they do a good job of decorating and sort of creating an atmosphere, and others where comes borderline to looking like a prom. I mean, a very big, expensive prom, but the Dark Continent was pretty fantastic. I think in Evening Excursion on the Orient Express was another really neat one, because they had, you know, just a variety of motifs, you know, different locations along the stop of the Orient Express, and it seemed the decorations were good that year. And I'm trying to think of performers or occurrences at any of these that made them particularly memorable, but none of them really do. Besides the year that B.B. King played for, I don't know how familiar you are with the whole sequence, but you know, we have a Thursday night concert at the Pavilion where usually a contemporary artist of some sort plays, and then the ball is on Friday night, and B.B. King played Thursday night one year, and that was fantastic. All the memories of Fancy Dress, both in law school and as an undergraduate, were very warm. I loved Fancy Dress during law school because it was my opportunity to be tour guide or docent to a lot of my law classmates who went to school elsewhere. And I always took a lot of pleasure in introducing friends and classmates in the law school to, you know, what I considered to be the, you know, really the best sides of Washington and Lee. And I had a lot of fun being able to do that. A lot of fun.
I had the same pleasure with my husband taking him to Fancy Dress.
Did you went this past?
Oh, yeah. I have not missed an event or a party since I got here. I go to everything.
That's great. Yeah. There's so much to.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get myself educated, and I pretended I was a freshman. We're running out of time. I don't want to shortchange this question. Tell me what the honor system means to you.
The honor system, for me in my house, is the single most defining aspect of this institution. It is, I think, notable for its simplicity in a world where, for its simplicity and its clarity in a world that is increasingly complex, where lines are increasingly blurred, and there are frequently more shades of gray than blacks and whites. It's almost like the golden rule, you know, to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You're expected to do your own work here. You're expected to mind your own property, and not to avail yourselves of others' property. And you're expected to be as good as your word. You will not lie, cheat, or steal. And I think, if I can borrow from the parlance of the Supreme Court, there's a penumbra of the honor system that is as important as the technical confines that you'll find in the White Book. And I think every Washington and Lee graduate will agree that the penumbra is that you are to act responsibly as an adult, even when you're playing. And if you don't, you take responsibility for it. That you are to be a gentleman, and that at the very least, you should feel a sense of loss when you're not. And that it's aspirational in that sense. I mean, besides perhaps Robert E. Lee himself and Sidney Cowling, could be perfect gentlemen. But it's a standard for, I think, men and women alike to live up to. And, you know, now as I'm practicing law, I really have seen how important the whole character issue is in terms of being able to rely on someone's word and to know that what they're telling you is the truth. And that, you know, so much of the grease in any kind of transaction, the wheels that turn a business deal or that help make a resolution of a conflict go smoothly rather than get caught up, has to do with personalities of people involved. And I think particularly when you're amongst your own, you know, when you know you're with someone from Washington and Lee, you know that the concept of the honor system is ingrained in them, that it's important, and the reputation of the honor system in professional fields and, you know, regionally around Virginia and the Southeast, people that are familiar with Washington and Lee, I think they still recognize that. But I always come back to, I think, what I just said about the penumbra of the honor system. You know, it's not only that you will lie, cheat, or steal, but that it really calls you to be the best that you can be in treating other people as you would expect to be treated, to be fair, and to think of others before yourself. And, you know, to all of this is, you know, trying to define what does it mean to be honorable, what does it mean to be a gentleman. I'm sure that's a topic of discussions that will continue to go on until the close of time. But that's the basis of what it means to me. As I will say, I mean, probably the most poignant time of my years at Washington and Lee occurred as a third-year law student when I was the president of the student body in the law school, or the president, you're known as the Student Bar Association president. And one of the responsibilities of the Student Bar Association president is that in the event that there is an open honor trial, I don't know how familiar you are with the whole white book procedure. Well, the way the honor system works here, roughly, is there are two levels of proceedings. If you are accused of an honor violation, you are brought before the executive committee in what's known as a closed hearing. And they vote, you know, there's a hearing that's held, and they vote on whether or not they think you're guilty. If you're found guilty, you have two options. You can either withdraw from the university and go about your merry way, or you can essentially appeal that decision to a jury of your peers, which is open. It's held in Lee Chapel, usually, and it's open to all members of the Washington and Lee community. And the Student Bar Association, the SBA president, is the judge or the chair of that open trial. The executive committee shifts from being, in essence, the judge and the jury in the closed hearing to being the prosecutor in an open hearing. And so it's essentially, there's a third party, supposedly a neutral third party, who's the SBA president. Long and short of it is, my third year, I was called upon to chair an open hearing in Lee Chapel, which was the first one that the university had seen in, I think, 2 or 3 years. Usually there are one or two a year. And the proceedings had taken place throughout the whole day. And I remember that the jury had retired to deliberate, And everyone was scattered around the front lawn here waiting for them to come back, and we were all just sitting and waiting. And I got the phone call that they had reached a verdict and they'd be coming back. So I called my sergeants at arms and I told them, we'll get everybody back in the chapel and we'll wait on the jury. We'll have them come in through the basement of the chapel so they don't have to walk through the crowd and come up. And so the sergeants at arms brought them back in. They were all sitting there. And it was, I imagine it was about 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the early spring. And the sun was coming through the windows of Lee Chapel and illuminating the chapel with almost an eerie orange glow. And I was sitting facing everyone in Lee Chapel, and the chapel was packed. Everyone was waiting to hear the verdict. The jury hadn't come back yet. And there was probably a 2-minute wait before the jury came in, and it seemed to go on for hours. And every single person I looked at out in the crowd, I was making eye contact with. And just everything about the honor system, and I think just the gravity of what was taking place, to me, that was the defining moment of it. And I'll never forget that moment and the way that the whole experience just kind of was driven home by the look on everyone's face in the crowd that I made eye contact with, and realizing that, you know, we as a community take the honor system serious enough to go through this. And, you know, I'll never forget it. Very, very sobering, and I think very poignant. So, I'd do it again. If I had to do all over, when I was just a freshman knowing everything I know now, or just a junior or senior in high school, I'd do it again. I'm lucky enough to have any kids. First of all, I want them to go wherever they want to go, but I hope wherever they want to go is Washington.
That's a wonderful way to end it, John. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been a real pleasure.